chapter 40. As the men following Tom emerged from the trees below and into the open, Richard was dismayed to see that their numbers were far less than Owen said had been hiding with him in the hills. Rubbing the furrows on his brow with his fingertips, Richard stepped back up to the short plateau where Kaelin waited. Her own brow drew down with concern.
"What's wrong?"
"I doubt they brought 50 men." Kaelin took up his hand again, her voice coming in gentle assurance.
"That's 50 more than we had."
Kara came up behind him, dropping her load off to the side. She took up station behind Richard to his left on the opposite side of Kaelin. Richard met her grim gaze. He wondered how the woman always managed to look as if she fully expected everything to happen just as she wished it to happen, and that was the end of it. Tom stepped up over the edge of the rock, the men following. He was sweating from the exertion of the climb, but a tight smile warmed his face when he saw Jensen just coming up the other side of the rise. She returned the brief smile and then stood in the shadows beside the base of the statue, back out of the way. When the unkempt band of men caught sight of Richard in his black pants and boots, black tunic trimmed in a band of gold around the edge, the broad leather belt, the leather-padded silver wristbands with ancient symbols encircling them, and the gleaming silver and gold wrought scabbard, they seemed to lose their courage. When they saw Kaelin standing beside him, they cowered back toward the edge, bowing hesitantly, not knowing what they were supposed to do.
"Come on, then," Tom told them, prompting them all to come up onto the expanse of flat rock in front of Richard and Kaelin.
Owen whispered to the men as he moved among them, urging them to come forward as Tom was gesturing. They complied timidly, shuffling in a little closer, but still weaving a wide safety margin between themselves and Richard. As the men all gazed about, unsure as to what they were supposed to do next, Kara stepped forward and held an arm out toward Richard.
"I present Lord Rawl," she said in a clear tone that rang out over the men gathered at the top of the pass. "The seeker of truth and wielder of the sword of truth, the bringer of death, the master of the Dharan Empire, and husband to the Mother Confessor herself."
If the men had looked timid and unsure before, Kara's introduction made them all the more so. When they looked from Richard and Kaelin back to Kara's penetrating blue eyes, seeing her waiting, they all went to a knee in a bow before Richard. When Kara stepped deliberately to the fore, in front of the men, turned and went to her knees, Tom got the message and did the same. Both bent forward and touched their foreheads to the ground. In the silent late morning air, the men waited, still unsure what it was they were to do.
"Master Rawl, guide us," Kara said in a clear voice so the men could all hear her. She waited.
Tom looked back over his shoulder at all the blond-headed men watching. When Tom frowned with displeasure, the men understood that they were expected to follow the lead. They all finally went to both knees and bowed forward, imitating Tom and Kara until their foreheads touched the cold granite.
"Master Rawl, guide us," Kara began again, never lifting her forehead from the ground.
This time, led by Tom, the men all repeated the words after her.
"Master Rawl, guide us," they said with a decided lack of unity.
"Master Rawl, teach us," Kara said. When they all had finished the beginning of the oath,
they followed her lead again, but still hesitantly and without much coordination.
"Master Rawl, protect us," Kara said.
The men repeated the words, their voices coming a little more in union.
"In your light we thrive,"
the men mumbled the words after her.
"In your mercy we are sheltered,"
they repeated the line.
"In your wisdom we are humbled,"
again they spoke the words after her.
"We live only to serve."
When they finished repeating the words, she spoke the last line in a clear voice.
"Our lives are yours."
Kara rose up on her knees when they finished and glared back at the men, all still bowed forward but peeking up at her.
"Those are the words of the devotion to the Lord Rawl. You will now speak it together with me three times, as is proper in the field."
Kara again put her forehead to the ground at Richard's feet.
"Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve."
Our lives are yours.
Richard and Kalin stood above the people as they spoke the second and third devotion. This was no empty show put on by Kara for the benefit of the men. This was the devotion as it had been spoken for thousands of years, and Kara meant every word of it.
You may rise now, she told the men.
The men cautiously returned to their feet, hunched in worry, waiting silently. Richard met all their eyes before he began.
I am Richard Rawl. I am the man you men decided to poison so as to enslave me and thus force me to do your bidding. What you have done is a crime. While you may believe that you can justify your action as proper, or think of it as merely a means of persuasion, nothing can give you the right to threaten or take the life of another who has done you no harm, nor intended none. That, along with torture, rape, and murder, is the means by which the Imperial Order rules.
But we meant you no harm, one of them called out in horror, that Richard would accuse them of such a ghastly crime. Other men spoke up in agreement that Richard had it all wrong.
You think I am a savage, Richard said in a tone of voice that silenced them and put them back a step. You think yourselves better than me, and so that somehow makes it all right to do this to me, and to try to do it to the Mother Confessor. Because you want something, and like petulant children, you expect us to give it to you. The alternative you give me is death. The task you demand of me is difficult beyond your imagination, making my death from your poison a very real possibility and likely. That is the reality of it. I already came close to dying from your poison. At the last possible instant, I was granted a temporary stay of my execution when one of you gave me a provisional antidote. My friends and loved ones believed I would die that night. You were the cause of it. You men consciously decided to poison me, thereby accepting the fact that you might be killing me.
No, a man insisted, his hands clasped in supplication. We never intended to harm you.
If there was not a credible threat to my life, then why would I do as you wish? If you truly mean me no harm, and are not committed to killing me if I don't go along with you, then prove it and give me the antidote, so that I can have my life back. It's my life, not yours.
This time, no one spoke up.
No? So you see, then, it is as I say. You men are committed to either murder or enslavement. The only choice I have in it is which of those two it will be. I will hear no more of your feelings about what you intended. Your feelings do not absolve you of your very real deeds. Your actions, not your feelings, speak the truth of your intent.
Richard clasped his hands behind his back as he paced slowly before the men.
Now, I could do as you people are fond of doing and tell myself that I can't know if any of it is true. I could do as you would do, declare myself inadequate to the task of knowing what's real and refuse to face reality. But I am the seeker of truth because I do not try to hide from reality. The choice to live demands that the truth be faced. I intend to do that. I intend to live. You men must today decide what you will do. What will be the future of your lives and the lives of the ones you love? You are going to have to deal with reality the same as I must, if you are to have a chance at life. Today, you will have to face a great deal of the truth, if you are to have that which you seek.
Richard gestured to Owen. I thought you said there were more men than this. Where are the rest?
Owen took a step forward. Lord Rawl, to prevent violence, they turned themselves over to the men of the Order.
Richard stared at the man. Owen, after all you've told me, after all those men have seen from the Order, how could they possibly believe such a thing?
But how are we to know that this time it will not stop the violence? We can't know the nature of reality or...
I told you before, with me you will confine yourself to what is and not repeat meaningless phrases you have memorized. If you have real facts, I want to hear them. I'm not interested in meaningless nonsense.
Owen finally stepped forward and pulled his small pack off his back. He fished around inside and came up with a small canvas pouch. Tears welled up in his eyes as he gazed at it.
The men of the Order found out that there were men hiding out in the hills. One of those men hiding with us has three daughters. In order to prevent a cycle of violence,
Someone in our town told the men of the order which girls were his daughters. Every day the men of the order tied a rope to a finger of each one of these three girls. One man held a girl while another pulled on the rope until her finger tore off. The men of the order told a man from our town to go to the hills and give the three fingers to our men. Every day he came.
Owen handed the bag to Richard.
These are the fingers from each of his daughters. The man who brought them to our men was in a daze. They said he no longer seemed human. He talked in a dead voice. He repeated what he had been bidden to say. He had decided that since nothing was real, he would see nothing and do as he was told. He said that the men of the order told him that some of the people from our town had given the names of the men in the hills and that they had the children of those other men as well. They said that unless the men returned and gave themselves up, they would do the same to the other children. A little more than half the men hiding in the hills could not stand to think of themselves being the cause of such violence, and so they went back to our town and gave themselves over to the men of the order.
"Why are you giving me this?" Richard asked.
"Because," Owen said, his voice filled with tears, "I wanted you to know why our men had no choice but to turn themselves in. They could not stand to think of their loved ones suffering such terrible agony because of them."
Richard looked out at the mournful men watching him. He felt his anger boiling up inside, but he kept it in check as he spoke. "I can understand what those men were trying to do by giving themselves up. I can't fault them for it. It won't help, but I couldn't fault them for desperately wanting to spare their loved ones from harm." Despite his rage, Richard spoke in a soft voice. "I'm sorry that you and your people are suffering such brutality at the hands of the Imperial Order. But understand this, it is real, and the Order is the cause of it. Those men of yours, if they did as the Order commanded, or if they failed to, were not the cause of violence. The responsibility for causing violence is entirely the Order's. You did not go out and attack them. They came to you. They attacked you. They enslave and torture and murder you." Most of the men stood in slumped poses, staring at the ground. "Do any of the rest of you have children?" A number of the men nodded or mumbled that they did. Richard ran his hand back through his hair. "Why haven't the rest of you turned yourselves in then? Why are you here and not trying to stop the suffering in the same way the others did?" The men looked at each other, some seeming confused by the question, while others appeared unable to put their reasons into words. Their sorrow, their distress, even their hesitant resolve was evident on their faces. But they could not come up with words to explain why they would not turn themselves in. Richard held up the small canvas bag with the gruesome treasure, not allowing them to avoid the issue. "You all knew about this. Why did you not return as well?" Finally, one man spoke up. "I sneaked to the fields at sunset and talked to a man working the crops and asked what happened to those men who had returned. He said that many of their children had already been taken away. Others had died. All the men who had come in from the hills had been taken away. None were allowed to return to their homes, to their families. What good would it do for us to go back?" "What good indeed," Richard murmured. This was the first sign that they grasped the true nature of the situation.
"You have to stop the order," Owen said. "You must give us our freedom. Why have you made us make this journey?"
Richard's initial spark of confidence dimmed. While they might have in part grasped the truth of their troubles, they certainly weren't facing the nature of any real solution. They simply wanted to be saved. They still expected someone to do it for them. Richard. The men all looked relieved that Owen had at last asked the question. They were apparently too timid to ask it themselves. As they waited, some of the men couldn't help stealing glances at Jensen, standing to the rear. Most of the men also appeared troubled by the statue looming behind Richard. They could only see the back of it and didn't really know what it was meant to be. "Because," Richard finally told them, "in order for me to do as you want, it's important that you all come to understand everything involved. You expect me to simply do this for you. I can't. You are going to have to help me in this, or you and all of your loved ones are lost. If we are to succeed, then you men must help the rest of your people come to understand the things I have to tell you. You have gone this far. You have suffered this much. You have made this much of a commitment.
you realize that if you do the same as your friends have been trying to do, if you apply those same useless solutions, you too will be enslaved or murdered. You are running out of options. You all have made a decision to at least try to succeed, to try to rid yourselves of the brutes killing and enslaving your people. You men here are their last chance, their only chance. You must now hear the rest of what I have to tell you, and then make up your minds as to what will be your future. The haggard, ragtag men, all dressed in worn and dirty clothes, all looking like they'd had a very difficult time of living in the hills, either spoke up or nodded that they would hear him out. Some even looked as if they might be relieved by how directly and honestly he spoke to them. A few even looked hungry for what he might say. Chapter 41. 3 years ago, from the coming autumn, Richard began, I lived in a place called Heartland. I was a woods guide. I had a peaceful life in a place I loved among those I loved. I knew very little about the places beyond my home. In some ways, I was like you people before the order came, so I can understand some of what you felt about how things changed. Like you, I lived beyond a boundary that protected us from those who would do us harm. The men broke out in excited whispering, apparently surprised and pleased that they could relate to him in this way, that they had something so basic in common with him. What happened then? One of the men asked. Richard couldn't help himself. He couldn't hold back the smile that overwhelmed him. One day in my woods, he held his hand out to the side, Kaylin showed up. Like you, her people were in desperate trouble. She needed help. Rather than poison me, though, she told me her story and how trouble was coming our way. Much like you, the boundary protecting her people had failed, and a tyrant had invaded her homeland. She also came bearing a warning that this man would soon come to my homeland, too, and conquer my people, my friends, my loved ones. All the faces turned toward Kaylin. The men stared openly, as if seeing her for the first time. It looked to be astonishing to them that this statuesque woman before them could be a savage, as they thought of outsiders, and have the same kind of trouble they'd had. Richard was leaving out vast chunks of the story, but he wanted to keep it simple enough to be clear to these men. I was named the Seeker of Truth and given this sword to help me in this important struggle. Richard lifted the hilt clear of the scabbard, by half the length of the blade, letting the men all see the polished steel. Many grimaced at seeing such a weapon. Together, side by side, Kaylin and I struggled to stop the man who sought to enslave or destroy us all. In a strange land, she was my guide, not only helping me to fight against those who would kill us, but helping me to come to understand the wider world I had never before considered. She opened my eyes to what was out there, beyond the boundary that had protected me and my people. She helped me to see the approaching shadow of tyranny and know the true stakes involved, life itself. She made me live up to the challenge. Had she not, I would not be alive today, and a great many more people would be dead or enslaved. Richard had to turn away then, at the flood of painful memories, at the thought of all those lost in the struggle, at the victories so hard won. He put his hand to the statue for support as he remembered the gruesome murder of George Cipher, the man who had raised him, the man who, until that struggle, Richard had always believed was his father. The pain of it, so distant and far away, came rushing up in him again. He remembered the horror of that time, of suddenly realizing that he would never again see the man he dearly loved. He had forgotten until that moment how much he missed him. Richard gathered his composure and turned back to the men. In the end, and only with Kaylin's help, I won the struggle against that tyrant I had never known existed until the day she had come into my woods and warned me. That man was Darken Rall, my father, a man I had never known. The men stared in disbelief. You never knew? Asked one in an astonished voice. Richard shook his head. It's a long story. Maybe another time I will tell you men all of it. For now I must tell you the important parts that are relevant to you and those you love back there in your homes. Richard looked at the ground before him thinking as he paced in front of the disorderly knot of men. When I killed Darken Rall, I did it to keep him from killing me and my loved ones.
He had tortured and murdered countless people, and that alone earned him death. But I had to kill him, or he would have killed me. I didn't know at the time that he was my real father, or that in killing him, since I was his heir, I would become the new Lord Rawl. Had he known who I was, he might not have been trying to kill me, but he didn't know. I had information he wanted. He intended to torture it out of me and then kill me. I killed him first. Since that time, I have come to learn a great deal. What I learn connects us. Richard gestured to the men and then placed his hand on his own chest as he met their gazes. In ways you must come to understand as well if you are to succeed in this new struggle. The land where I grew up, Kalin's land, and the land of Dahara, all make up the new world. As you have learned, this vast land down here outside where you grew up is called the Old World. After I became Lord Rawl, the barrier protecting us from the Old World failed, much as your own boundary failed. When it did, Emperor Jagang of the Imperial Order, down here in the Old World, used the opportunity to invade the New World, my home, much as he invaded your home. We've been fighting him and his troops for over 2 years, trying to defeat them or at least to drive them back to the Old World. The barrier that failed had protected us from the Order, or men like them, for around 3,000 years, longer even than you were protected. Before that barrier was placed at the end of a great war, the enemy at the time, from the Old World, had used magic to create people called Dreamwalkers. The men fell to whispering. They had heard the name, but they didn't really understand it and speculated on what it could mean. Dreamwalkers, Richard explained, when they had quieted, could enter a person's mind in order to control them. There was no defense. Once a dreamwalker took over your mind, you became his slave, unable to resist his commands. The people back then were desperate. A man named Ulrich Rawl, my ancestor, came up with a way to protect people's minds from being taken over by the dreamwalkers. He was not only the Lord Rawl who ruled Dahara at the time, but he was also a great wizard. Through his ability, he created a bond that, when spoken earnestly or given in a more simple form with heartfelt sincerity, protected people from dreamwalkers entering their minds. Ulrich Rawl's link of magic to his people, through this bond, protected them. The devotion you men all gave is the formal declaration of that bond. It has been given by the Daharan people to their Lord Rawl for 3,000 years. Some of the men in front stepped forward, their faces etched with anxiety. Are we protected then from the Dreamwalkers, Lord Rawl, because we gave this oath? Are we protected from the Dreamwalkers entering our minds and taking us? Richard shook his head. You and your people need no protection. You are already protected in another way. Relief swept through the crowd of men. Some gripped the shoulder of another, or placed a hand in relief on a friend's back. They looked as if they feared the Dreamwalkers were stalking them, and they had just been spared at the last instant.
But how is it that we can be protected?
Owen asked. Richard took a deep breath, letting it out slowly. Well, that's the part that in a way connects us. You see, as I understand it, magic needs balance in order to function. There were knowing nods all around, as if these pristinely ungifted men all had an intimate understanding of magic. When Ulrich Rawl used magic to create this bond in order to protect his people, Richard went on, there needed to always be a Lord Rawl to complete the bond, to maintain its power. Not all wizards bear children who also possess this gifted ability. So part of what Ulrich Rawl did when he created this bond was to make it so that the Lord Rawl would always bear one son who had magic, who had the gift, and could complete this bond with the people of Dahara. In this way, they would always be protected. Richard held up a finger to make his point as he swept his gaze over the crowd of men. What they didn't know at the time was that this magic inadvertently created its own balance. While the Lord Rawl always produced a gifted heir, wizard like him, it was only discovered later that he also occasionally produced offspring who were entirely without any magic. Richard could see by the blank looks that the men didn't grasp what he was telling them. He imagined that for people living such isolated lives, his story must seem rather confusing, if not far-fetched. He remembered his own confusion about magic before the boundary had come down and he'd met Kalin. He hadn't been raised around magic, and he still didn't understand most of it himself.
He'd been born with both sides of the gift, and yet he didn't know how to control it.
"You see," he said, "only some people have magic, are gifted, as it's called. But all people are born with at least a very tiny spark of the gift, even though they can't manipulate magic. Until just recently, everyone thought of these people as ungifted. You see, the gifted, like wizards and sorceresses, can manipulate magic, and the rest of the people can't. So they were believed to be ungifted. But it turns out that this isn't accurate. Since there is an infinitesimal spark of the gift in everyone born, this tiny spark of the gift is actually what allows people to interact with the magic in the world around them. That is, with things and creatures that have magical properties, and with people who are gifted in a more comprehensive sense. Those who do have the ability to manipulate magic."
"Some people have magic in Bandakar, too," a man said. "True magic. Only those who have never seen..."
"No," Richard said, cutting him off. He didn't want them losing track of his account. "Owen told me about what you people believe is magic. That's not magic. That's mysticism. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about real magic that produces real results in the real world. Forget what you've been taught about magic, about how faith supposedly creates what you believe in, and that is real magic. It's not real. It's just the fanciful illusion of magic in people's imaginations."
"But it is real," someone said in a respectful but firm voice. "More real than what you see and feel."
Richard turned a harsh look on the man. "If it's so real, then why did you have to use a known poison on me that was mixed by a man who had worked his whole life with herbs? Because you know what's real, that's why. When it was vital to your self-interest, to your lives, you resorted to dealing in reality, to what you know really works."
Richard pointed back at Kalin.
"The Mother Confessor has real magic. It's no fanciful curse put on someone, and when they die 10 years later, people believe the curse was the cause. She has real magic that is in elemental ways linked to death, so it affects even you. She can touch someone with this real magic, and in an instant, they will be dead. Not 10 years from now, right now, on the spot."
Richard stood resolutely in front of the man, gazing from eye to eye.
"If someone doesn't believe that is real magic, then let's have a test. Let them perform their faith-based magic and put a spell on me to kill me right here and now. After they've done that, then they will come forward and be touched by the Mother Confessor's very real, lethal power. Then everyone else will be able to see the results and judge for themselves."
He looked from face to face. "Anyone willing to take up the test? Any magicians among all you ungifted people willing to try it?"
When the men remained silent, no one moving, Richard went on. "So it would seem that you men do have some understanding of what's real and what isn't. Keep that in mind. Learn from it. Now, I told you how the Lord Rawl always bore a son with magic so he could pass on the rule of Dahara and his gifted ability in order to make the bond work. But as I said, the bond that Ulrich Rawl created may have had an unintended consequence. Only later was it discovered that the Lord Rawl, possibly as a means of balance, also sometimes produced offspring that were entirely without any magic, not just ungifted in the way most people are, but unlike any people ever born before, they were pristinely ungifted. These pristinely ungifted people had absolutely no spark of the gift whatsoever. Because of that, because they were pristinely ungifted, they were unable to interact with the real magic in the world. They were unable to be touched by magic at all. For them, magic might as well not exist because they were not born with the ability to see it or to interact with it. You might say they were like a bird that could not fly. They looked like a bird. They had feathers. They ate bugs. But they couldn't fly. Back then in that time, 3,000 years ago, after the bond had been created to protect people from dreamwalkers in the war, the wizards finally succeeded in placing a barrier between the old and the new world. Because those in the old world could no longer come to the new world to wage war, the Great War ended. Peace finally came. The people of the new world discovered, though, that they had a problem. These pristinely ungifted offspring of the Lord Rawl passed this trait on to their children. Every offspring of a marriage with at least one of these pristinely ungifted partners bears pristinely ungifted children, always, every time. As these offspring married and had children and then grandchildren and then great-grandchildren,
As there were more and more of them, that pristinely ungifted trait began spreading throughout the population. People at the time were frightened because they depended on magic. Magic was part of their world. Magic was what had saved them from the dreamwalkers. Magic had created the barrier that protected them from the horde of the old world. Magic had ended the war. Magic healed people, found lost children, produced beautiful creations of art that inspired and brought joy. Magic could help guide people in the course of future events. Some towns grew up around a gifted person who could serve people's needs. Many gifted people earned a living performing such services. In some things, magic gave people control over nature and thus made the lives of everyone better. Things accomplished with the aid of magic improved the living conditions of nearly everyone. Magic was a force of individual creation and thus individual accomplishment. Nearly everyone derived some benefit from it. This is not to say that magic was or is indispensable, but that it was a useful aid, a tool. Magic was like their right arm. Yet, it's the mind of a man, not his magic, that is indispensable. Much in the way that you could survive without your right arm, but you couldn't survive without your mind. But magic had become intertwined in the lives of everyone, so many people believed that it was absolutely indispensable. The people came to feel that this new threat, the pristinely ungifted trait spreading throughout the population, would be the end of everything they knew, everything that they thought was important, that it would be the end of their most vital protection, magic. Richard gazed out at all the faces, waiting to make sure that the men had grasped the essence of the story, that they understood how desperate the people must have been and why. "So, what did the people do about these new pristinely ungifted people among them?" a man in the back asked. In a quiet tone, Richard said, "Something terrible." He pulled the book from a leather pouch on his belt and held it up for all the men to see as he again paced before them. The clouds, laden with storms of snow, rolled silently through the frigid valley pass, bound for the peaks above them. "This book is called The Pillars of Creation. That's what the wizards back then called these pristinely ungifted people, pillars of creation, because they had the power, with this trait that they passed along to their offspring, to alter the very nature of mankind. They were the foundation of an entirely new kind of people, people without any connection to magic. I only just a short time ago came across this book. It's meant for the Lord Rawl and others, so that they will know about these pristinely ungifted people who are unaffected by magic. The book tells the history of how these people came about, through those born to the Lord Rawl, along with the history of what was discovered about them. It also reveals what the people back then, thousands of years ago, did about these pillars of creation." Men rubbed their arms in the cold air as Richard slowly paced before them. They all looked caught up in the story. "So," Owen asked, "what did they do?" Richard came to a stop and stood watching their eyes before he spoke. "They banished them." Astonished whispering broke out among the men. They were stunned to hear the final solution. These people understood banishment. They understood it all too well. And they could sympathize with these banished people of so long ago. "That's terrible," a man in front said, shaking his head. Another frowned and held up a hand. "Weren't these pillars of creation related to some of the other people? Weren't they part of the towns? Didn't the people feel sorrow at banishing these ungifted people?" Richard nodded. "Yes, they were friends and family. Those banished people were intimately intertwined in the lives of nearly everyone. The book tells how heavy-hearted the people felt at the decision that had been reached about these pristinely ungifted people. It must have been an awful time, a dreadful choice that no one liked, but those in charge at the time decided that in order for them to preserve their way of life, to preserve magic and all it meant to them, to preserve that attribute of man, rather than value the lives of individuals for who they were, they had to banish these pristinely ungifted people. What's more, they also decreed that all future offspring of the Lord Rawl, except his gifted heir, should be put to death, to ensure that no pillar of creation ever again came among them." This time there was no whispering. The men looked saddened by the story of these mysterious people and the terrible solution of how to deal with them. Heads hung as the men thought about what it must have been like back in such a grim time. Finally, a man's head came up.
His brow twitched. He finally asked the question Richard expected to be asked, the question he had been waiting for.
But where were these pillars of creation banished to? Where were they sent?
Richard watched the man as other eyes turned up, curious about the historic mystery, waiting for him to go on.
These people were not affected by magic, Richard reminded them, and the barrier holding back the old world was a barrier created of magic.
They sent them through the barrier, a man guessed aloud. Richard nodded.
Many wizards had died and given their power into that barrier so that their people would be protected from those in the old world who wanted to rule them and to end magic. That was a large part of what the war had been fought over. Those in the old world had wanted to eradicate magic from mankind. So those people in the new world sent these pristinely ungifted people, these people without magic, through the barrier to the old world. They never knew what became of them. Those friends and family and loved ones, they had banished, because they had been sent beyond a barrier that none of them could cross. It was thought that they would establish new lives, would make a new beginning. But because the barrier was there, and it was enemy territory beyond, the people of the new world never knew what became of those banished people. Finally, a few years ago, that barrier came down. If these banished people had made a life for themselves in the old world, they would have had children and spread their pristinely ungifted attribute. Richard lifted his arms in a shrug. But there is no trace of them. The people down here are just the same as the people up in the new world. Some born gifted, but all born with at least that tiny spark of the gift that enables them to interact with magic. Those people from ancient times seem just to have vanished.
So now we know, Owen reasoned, as he stared off in thought, that all those people sent to the old world so long ago tragically died out, or maybe were killed.
I had thought as much myself, Richard said. He turned and faced the men, waiting until all eyes were on him before going on. But then I found them. I found those long-lost people.
Excited whispering broke out again. The men appeared inspired by the prospect of such people surviving against all odds.
Where are they then, Lord Rawl? A man asked. These people with whom you share ancestry. These people who had to endure such cruel banishment and hardship.
Richard leveled a cutting gaze at the men. Come with me, and I will tell you what became of these people. Richard led them around the statue to the front, where for the first time they could see the full view of the sentinel in stone. The men were awe-stricken at finally seeing the statue from the front. They talked excitedly among themselves about how real it looked, about how they could clearly see the stalwart features of the man's face. By the utter shock in their voices and by what the men were saying, Richard got the distinct impression that they'd never seen a statue before, at least no statue as monumental as this one. It appeared that for these men, the statue must be something akin to a manifestation of magic rather than, as Richard knew it to be, a manifestation of man's ability. Richard placed a hand on the cold stone of the base. This is an ancient statue of an old-world wizard named Kajarang. It was carved, in part, as a tribute to the man because he was a great and powerful wizard. Owen lifted a hand to interrupt.
But I thought the people in the old world wanted to be without magic. Why would they have a great wizard, and why especially would they pay a tribute to such a man of magic?
Richard smiled at Owen, catching the contradictions. People don't always act in a consistent manner. What's more, the more irrational are your beliefs, the more glaring the inconsistencies. You men, for example, try to gloss over incongruities in your behavior by applying your convictions selectively. You claim that nothing is real, or that we cannot know the true nature of reality, and yet you fear what the Order does to you. You believe firmly enough in the reality of what they're doing that you want it to stop. If nothing were real, then you would have no reason to want to stop the Imperial Order. In fact, it's counter to your professed beliefs to try to stop them, or to even feel that their presence is real, much less detrimental, since you assert that man is inadequate to the task of knowing reality. Yet you grasp the reality of what's happening at the hands of the men of the Order, and know very well that it's abhorrent. So you selectively suspend the precepts of your beliefs in order to send Owen to poison me in an attempt to get me to rid you of your very real problem.
Some of the men looked confused by what Richard said, while others looked to be embarrassed. A few looked astonished. None looked willing to challenge him, so they let him go on without interrupting. The people in the old world were the same way. They still are. They claimed they didn't want magic, and yet when faced with that reality, they didn't want to do without it. The Imperial Order is like this. They've come to the New World claiming to be a champion of freeing mankind of magic, proclaiming themselves to be noble for holding such a goal, and yet they use magic in the pursuit of this professed goal. They contend that magic is evil, and yet they embrace it. Their leader, Emperor Jigang, uses those with magic to help accomplish his ends, among which, he claims, is the eradication of magic. Jigang is a dreamwalker descended from those dreamwalkers of so long ago. His ability as a dreamwalker is magic, yet he does not disqualify himself from leading his empire, even though he has magic, which he claims makes people unfit to have any say in the future. He calls himself Jigang the Just. Despite what they declare they believe, their goal is to rule people, plain and simple. They simply seek power but dress it up in noble-sounding robes. Every tyrant thinks he is different. They are all the same. They all rule by brute force. Owen was frowning, trying to grasp it all. So those in the old world did not live by their word, by what they claimed they believed. They lived in conflict. They preached that man was better without magic, but they continued to want to use magic. That's right. Owen gestured up at the statue. What of this man, then? Why is he here, if he is against what they preached? Dark clouds roiled above the towering statue. The still air hung cold, heavy and damp. It felt as if a storm were holding back its onslaught, waiting to hear the rest. This man is here because he fought to save the people of the old world from something they feared more than magic itself, Richard said. He gazed up at the resolute face with its eyes fixed forever on the place called the Pillars of Creation. This man, Richard said in a quiet voice, this wizard, Kaja Rang, collected all of those pristinely ungifted people, those pillars of creation who had been banished down here from the New World, along with any people who, while they lived here, had joined with them, and he sent them all there. Richard pointed off into the distance behind the statue. He put all those people in that place, protected by the mountains all around, and then he placed a boundary of death before them, across this pass, so that they could never again come out to be among the rest of the people of the world. Kaja Rang gave these people their name, the Bandakar. The name Bandakar is from a very old language called High Daharan. It means the banished. This man, Kaja Rang, is the one who sealed them in and saved his people from the pristinely ungifted, from those without magic. You, Richard said to the men before him, are the descendants of those banished people. You are the descendants of Ulrich Rall, of the people sent into exile in the old world. You are all descendants of the House of Rall. Your ancestors and mine are the same men. You are the banished people. The top of the pass before the statue of Kaja Rang was dead silent. The men stared in shock. And then pandemonium broke out. Richard made no effort to stop them, to bring them to be quiet. Rather, he stood close beside Kalin as he let them take it in. He wanted to give them the time they needed to come to grasp the enormity of what he had told them. Arms in the air, some men cried out with the outrage at what they'd heard. Others wailed with the horror of the story. Some wept in sorrow. Many argued. A few protested various points that others answered, while yet others repeated key elements to one another almost as if to hear the words again so that they could test them, agreeing finally that it might very well be so. But through it all, they all slowly began to grasp the enormity of what they'd heard. They all began to hear the ring of truth in the story. Chattering like magpies, all talking at once, they expressed disbelief, outrage, wonder, even fear, as they came to the heady comprehension of who they really were. At the whispered urging of some among the group, after having gotten over the initial shock, the men all quieted and at last turned back to Richard, hungry to know more.
"You are this gifted man, this favored heir, the Lord Rahl, and we are the ones banished by your kind," one of the men said, expressing what looked to be a common fear, the unspoken question of what this would mean for them. "That's right," Richard said. "I am the Lord Rahl, the leader of the Dharan Empire, and you are the descendants of the Pillars of Creation who were banished. I am gifted, as have been my ancestors, every Lord Rahl before me. You are ungifted, as were your ancestors." Standing before the statue of Khaja Rang, the man who had banished them, Richard looked out at all the tense faces. "That banishment was a grievous wrong. It was immoral. As Lord Rahl, I denounce the banishment and declare it forever ended. You are no longer the Empire of Bandakar, the Banished Ones. You are now once again, as you once were, Dharans, if you choose to be." Every man seemed to hold his breath, waiting to see if he meant it, or would add more, or if he might even recant it. Richard put his arm around Kalin's waist as he calmly gazed out at all the hopeful expressions. Richard smiled. "Welcome home." And then they were all falling at his feet, kissing his boots, his pants, his hands, and for those who couldn't crowd in close enough, the ground before him. In short order, they were kissing the hem of Kalin's dress. They had found a relation and were in turn welcoming him among them. Chapter 42. As the men crowded around their feet, openly offering their gratitude for ending their sentence of banishment, Richard shared a sidelong glance with Kalin. Kara looked decidedly displeased by the display, but didn't interfere. Trying to bring a halt to the tearful tribute, Richard gestured for the men to get up. "There is much more to tell you. Listen to me now." The smiling, tearful men drew back, hands clasped, while gazing at him, as if he were a long-lost brother. There were a few older men among the crowd, and some of middle age, but most ranged from young, like Owen, to a little older, like Richard. They were all men who had been through terrible times. The most difficult part still lay ahead. Richard had to make them face up to what was to come. Looking over at Jensen, standing alone, off to the side, he gestured for her to come forward. Jensen emerged from the shadows of the statue, catching the attention of all eyes as she made her way toward Richard. The men all watched her coming into the light. She looked so beautiful that Richard couldn't help smiling as she stepped across the rocks. Pulling on a red ringlet, she cast a shy glance at the men. When Richard held an arm out, she sought protection under the shelter of that arm as she gazed nervously out at the men, who were like her in one important way. "This is my sister, Jensen Rahl," Richard said. "She was born pristinely ungifted, just like all of you. Our father tried to kill her, as has been done for thousands of years with ungifted offspring." "And you?" a man asked, still skeptical. "You will not reject her?" Richard hugged Jensen with the one arm. "For what? For what crime should I reject her? Because she was born a woman instead of a man like me? Because she isn't as tall as me? Because she has red hair instead of hair like mine? Because her eyes are blue and not gray? Because she is ungifted?" The men shifted their weight to the other foot or folded their arms. Some, after all he had already said, averted their eyes, looking embarrassed to have even asked the question. "She's beautiful, smart, and uses her head. She, too, fights for her right to live, and does so through reasoned means. She is, as you men, pristinely ungifted. Because she shares an understanding of the value of life, I embrace her." Richard heard the bleat and turned. Betty, her rope trailing behind, trotted up the rise. Jensen rolled her eyes as Betty came close, peering up, her tail wagging in a blur. Jensen snatched up the rope. Inspecting the end, Richard could see that it had been chewed through. "Betty!" she scolded, shaking the end of the rope at the unrepentant goat. "What did you do?" Betty bleated her answer, clearly proud of herself. Jensen heaved a sigh as she shrugged an apology at Richard. The men had all taken several steps back, murmuring their dread to one another. "I'm not a witch," Jensen told them in a heated tone. "Just because I have red hair, that doesn't mean I'm a witch." The men looked thoroughly unconvinced. "I've had dealings with a very real witch woman,"
Richard told them. I can assure you, red hair is no mark of a witch. It just isn't true.
It is true, one of the men insisted. He pointed at Betty. There is her attendant spirit.
Richard's brow wrinkled. Attendant spirit?
That's right, another told him. A witch always has a familiar with her. She called her attendant spirit, and it came to her.
Called her?
Jensen brandished the frayed end of the rope at the man.
I tied her to a tree, and she chewed through the rope.
Another man shook his finger at her.
You called her with magic, and she came.
Fists at her sides, Jensen took a step toward the men. They took a collective step back.
You men all had family and friends, a community of people. I had no friends and could have none because my mother and I had to run from my father my whole life to keep from being caught. He would have tortured and murdered me, had he caught me, the same as he would have done with you. I could have no childhood friends, so my mother gave me Betty. Betty was just newborn. We grew up together. Betty chewed through her rope because I'm the only family she's ever known, and she simply wanted to be close to me. I was banished from everyone for my crime of birth, just like your ancestors. You all know the injustice of such banishment, and you know its pain. And now you foolish men would banish me from your acceptance because I have red hair and a goat as a pet? You are spineless cowards and hypocrites. First you poison the only person in the world brave enough to end our banishment from the rest of mankind, and now you fear me and reject me because of silly superstitions. If I did have magic, I'd burn you all to a cinder for your cruel attitudes.
Richard put a hand on her shoulder and drew her back. It will be all right, he whispered to her. Just let me talk to them.
You tell us you're a wizard, an older man in the back called out. And then you expect us to believe it so, on faith, because you say it is, while you claim that we should not hold to our belief, such as our fear that she could be a witch with her familiar, because it's held only on faith.
That's right, another said. You claim your belief is in real magic, while you dismiss our belief. A lot of what you say makes sense, but I don't agree with all of it.
There could be no partial agreement. To reject part of the truth was to reject it all. Richard considered his options, how he could convince people without magic who could not see magic, that real magic existed. From their perspective, he seemed guilty of the same error he was telling them they were making. How could he demonstrate a rainbow of color to the blind?
You have a point, Richard said. Give me a moment, and I will show you the reality of the magic I talk about.
He motioned Kara closer. Get me the warning beacon, he said in a confidential tone. Kara immediately took off down the hill. He saw that Jensen's angry blue eyes were filled with tears, but she didn't cry. Kaelin pulled her farther back as Richard addressed the man.
There is more I must tell you, some things you need to understand. I have ended the banishment, but that does not mean that I unconditionally accept you back as one of our people.
But you said that we were welcomed home, Owen said.
I'm stating the obvious, that you have a right to your own life. Out of goodwill, I welcome you all to be part of Dahara, if you wish, part of what Dahara now stands for. But by welcoming you back, that does not mean that I welcome people unconditionally. All men should be free to live their own lives, but make no mistake, there is a vast difference between that freedom and anarchy. If we triumph in our struggle, you are welcome to be free people of a Daharan empire, which holds a belief in specific values. For example, you can think whatever you wish and try to persuade others of the value of your beliefs, but you cannot act on a view that those who fight to gain that freedom are savages or criminals, even though you expect to enjoy the fruits of their struggle. At minimum, they have earned your respect and gratitude. Their lives are no less than yours and are not expendable for your benefit. That is slavery.
But you have savage ways and engage in violence for a land we have never seen,
one of the younger men said.
He pointed an arm back toward Bandakar. The only land we have ever known is here, and we unconditionally reject your love of violence.
Land? Richard spread his arms. We do not fight for land. We are loyal to an ideal of liberty wherever man lives. We do not guard territory, bleed for a piece of dirt. We don't fight because we love violence. We fight for our freedom as individuals to live our own lives, to pursue our own survival, our own happiness. Your unconditional rejection of violence makes you smugly think of yourselves as noble,
as enlightened, but in reality it is nothing less than abject moral capitulation to evil. Unconditional rejection of self-defense because you think it's a supposed surrender to violence leaves you no resort but begging for mercy or offering appeasement. Evil grants no mercy, and to attempt to appease it is nothing more than a piecemeal surrender to it. Surrender to evil is slavery at best, death at worst. Thus, your unconditional rejection of violence is really nothing more than embracing death is preferable to life. You will achieve what you embrace. The right, the absolute necessity of vengeance against anyone who initiates force against you, is fundamental to survival. The morality of a people's self-defense is in its defense of each individual's right to life. It's an intolerance of violence made real by an unwavering willingness to crush any who would launch violence against you. The unconditional determination to destroy any who would initiate force against you is an exaltation of the value of life. Refusing to surrender your life to any thug or tyrant who lays claim to it is in fact embracing life itself. If you are unwilling to defend your right to your own lives, then you are merely like mice trying to argue with owls. You think their ways are wrong. They think you are dinner. The imperial order preaches that mankind is corrupt and evil, and therefore life is of little value. Their actions certainly bear this out. They moralize that you can only win salvation and happiness in some other world, and then only by sacrificing your life in this one. Generosity is fine, if it's by your free choice, but a belief in the primacy of self-sacrifice as a moral requisite is nothing less than the sanctioning of slavery. Those who tell you that it is your responsibility and duty to sacrifice are trying to blind you to the chains they are slipping around your neck. As Daharans, you will not be required to sacrifice your life to another, and by the same token you cannot demand that others sacrifice themselves to you. You may believe as you wish. You may even feel that you cannot take up arms and fight directly for our survival, but you must help support our cause, and you may not contribute materially or spiritually to the destruction of our values and therefore our lives. That is treason, and will be treated as such. The imperial order has violently invaded innocent lands like yours. They have enslaved, tortured, raped, and murdered in order to seize rule. They have done no less in the New World. They have forfeited their right to be heard. There is no moral dilemma involved, no ethical question open to debate. They must be ground into dust. A man stepped forward. But common decency in dealing with our fellow man requires that we must show them mercy for their misguided ways. There is no greater value than life, and that's what you partially recognize by your confused notion of granting mercy. Their conscious, deliberate act of murder takes the irreplaceable value of life from another. A murderer, by his own choice to kill, forfeits the right to his own life. Mercy for such evil is nothing short of excusing it, and thus allowing evil to prevail. It codifies the taking of innocent life by not making the murderer forfeit their own guilty life. Mercy grants value to the life of a killer, while at the same time it strips away the value of the life of the innocent victim. It makes the life of a killer more important than the life of an innocent. It is thus a trade of the good to the evil. It is the victory of death over life. So, Owen wondered aloud, because the order has attacked your land and murdered its people, you intend to try and kill every living person in the old world? No. The order is evil, and from the old world. That does not mean that the people of the old world are evil simply because they happen to have been born on a patch of ground ruled by evil men. Some actively support these rulers and therefore embrace evil, but not everyone does. Many of the people in the old world are also the victims of the rule of the imperial order and suffer greatly under its brutality. Many struggle against this evil rule. As we speak, many risk their lives to rid themselves of these evil men. We fight for the same thing, liberty. Where those who seek liberty were born is irrelevant. We believe in the value of the individual's life. That means that where someone lives does not make them evil. It's their beliefs and actions that matter. But make no mistake, many people are an active part of the imperial order and its murderous ways. Actions must have consequences. The order must be eradicated.
Surely you would allow some compromise, one of the older men said.
If hoping to appease it, you willingly compromise with unrepentant evil, you only allow such evil to sink its fangs into you. From that day on, its venom will course through your veins until it finally kills you.
But that's too harsh a sentiment, the man said. It's just being stubborn and obstructing a constructive path. There is always room for compromise.
Richard tapped his thumb against his chest. You men decided to give me poison. That poison will kill me. That makes it evil. How would you suggest I compromise with poison? No one had an answer. In trade between willing parties who share moral values and who deal fairly and honestly with one another, compromise over something like price is legitimate. In matters of morality or truth, there can be no compromise. Compromising with murderers, which is precisely what you are suggesting, grants them moral equivalence where none can rightfully exist. Moral equivalence says that you are no better than they, therefore, their belief that they should be able to torture, rape, or murder you is just as morally valid as your view that you have the right to live free of their violence. Moral compromise rejects the concept of right and wrong. It says that everyone is equal, all desires are equally valid, all action is equally valid, so everyone should compromise to get along. Where could you compromise with those who torture, rape, and murder people? In the number of days a week you will be tortured? In the number of men to be allowed to rape your loved ones? In how many of your family are to be murdered? No moral equivalence exists in that situation, nor can it exist. So there can be no compromise, only suicide. To even suggest compromise can exist with such men is to sanction murder. Most of the men appeared shocked and startled to hear someone speaking to them in such a straightforward manner. They seemed to be losing interest in their supply of empty adages. Some of the men looked to be moved by Richard's words. A few even looked inspired by their clarity. He could see it in their eyes, as if they were seeing things for the first time. Kara came up behind Richard and handed him the warning beacon. Richard wasn't sure, but it seemed as if the inky black had taken over more of the surface of the small figure than the last time he'd seen it. Inside, the sand continued to trickle down onto the accumulated pile on the bottom. Kaja Rang placed the boundary across this pass to seal your people in. He is the one who named you. He knew your people shunned violence, and he feared you might end up being prey to criminals. He is the one who gave you a way to banish them from your land so that you could continue to have the kind of life you wanted. He told your people of the passage through the boundary so that you could rid yourselves of criminals if you rallied the will. Owen looked troubled. If this great wizard, Kaja Rang, didn't want our people among the population of the old world because we would mix with them and spread our pristinely ungifted trait, as you call it, then what about the criminals we banish? Sending those men out into the world would cause the thing they feared. Making this pass through the boundary and telling our ancestors about it would seem to defeat the whole purpose of the boundary. Richard smiled. Very good, Owen. You are beginning to think for yourself. Owen smiled. Richard gestured up at the statue of Kaja Rang. You see where he's looking? It's a place called the Pillars of Creation. It's a deathly hot place where nothing lives, a land stalked by death. The boundary that Kaja Rang placed had sides to it. When you sent people out of your land through the boundary, the walls of death to the sides prevented those banished people from escaping into the world at large. They had only one way they could go, the Pillars of Creation. Even with water and supplies, and knowing where you must go to get past it, trying to go through the valley known as the Pillars of Creation is almost certain death. Without water and supplies, without knowing the land, without knowing how to travel it, and where you must go to escape such a place, those you banished faced certain death. The man stared wide-eyed. Then, when we banished a criminal, we were actually executing them, one of the men said. That's right. This Kaja Rang tricked us then, the man added. Tricked us into what was actually the killing of those men. You think that a terrible trick? Richard asked. You people were deliberately setting known criminals loose on the world to prey on unsuspecting people. You were knowingly setting free violent men and condemning unsuspecting people outside your land to be victims of violence.
Rather than put murderers to death, you were, as far as you knew, had you given it any thought, knowingly assisting them in going on to kill others. In the blind attempt to avoid violence at all cost, you actually championed it. You told yourselves that those other people didn't matter because they weren't enlightened like you, that you were better than they because you were above violence, that you unconditionally rejected violence. If you even thought about it, you considered these people beyond the boundary to be savages, their lives unimportant. For all intents and purposes, you were sacrificing their innocent lives for the lives of those men you knew to be evil. What Kaja Rang was doing, besides keeping the pristinely ungifted from being at large in the world, was executing those criminals you banished before they could harm other people. You think yourselves noble in rejecting violence, but your actions would have fostered it. Only Kaja Rang's actions prevented it.
Dear Creator, it is far worse than that. Owen sank down, sitting heavily. Far worse than you even realize.
Other men, too, looked to be stricken with horror. Some had to lower themselves to the ground, as Owen had. Others, their faces in their hands, turned away or walked off a few paces.
What do you mean? Richard asked.
Owen looked up, his face ashen.
The story I told you about our land, about our town, and the other great cities? How in my town we all lived together and were happy with our lives?
Richard nodded.
Not all were.
Kaelin crossed her arms and leaned toward Owen.
What do you mean, not all were?
Owen lifted his hands in a helpless gesture.
Some wanted more than our simple, joyful life. Some people, well, they wanted to change things. They said they wanted to make things better. They wanted to improve our life, to build places for themselves, even though this is against our ways.
Owen is right, an older man said in a grim tone. In my time, I have seen a great many of these people who were unable to endure what some called the chafing principles of our empire.
And what happened when these people wanted to make these changes or could not endure the principles of your empire? Richard asked. Owen looked to each side, to the other dispirited faces.
The great speakers renounced their ideas. The wise ones said they would only bring strife among us. Their hopes for new ways were turned aside and they were denounced.
Owen swallowed.
So these people decided they would leave Bandakar. They went out of our land, taking the path through the opening in the boundary to find a new life for themselves. Not a single one ever returned to us.
Richard wiped a hand across his face. Then they died looking for their new life, a better life, than what you had to offer.
But you don't understand.
Owen rose to his feet.
We are like those people.
He swept his arm back at his men.
We have refused to go back and give ourselves over to the men of the Order, even though we know that people are being tortured because we hide. We know it will not stop the Order, so we don't go back. We have gone against the wishes of our great speakers and the Wise One to try to save our people. We have been denounced for what we choose to do. We have gone out of the past to seek information, to find a way to rid ourselves of the Imperial Order. Do you see, we are much the same as those others throughout our history. Like those others, we chose to leave and try to change things rather than to endure the way things were.
Then perhaps you are beginning to see, Richard said, that everything you were taught showed you only how to embrace death, not life. Perhaps you see that what you call the teaching of enlightenment was no more than blinders pulled over your eyes.
Richard put his hand on Owen's shoulder. He gazed down at the statue of himself in his other hand and then looked around at the tense faces.
You men are the ones left after all the rest have failed the tests. You alone got this far. You alone have started to use your minds to try to find a solution for you and your loved ones. You have much more to learn, but you have at least started to make some of the right choices. You must not stop now. You must meet with courage what I will call upon you to do, if you are to truly have a chance to save your loved ones.
For the first time, they looked at least a little proud. They had been recognized not for how well they repeated meaningless sayings, but for the decisions they reached on their own. Jensen was frowning in thought.
Richard, why couldn't people get back in through the passage, out through the boundary? If they wanted to go off and have a new life, but then discovered that they would have to go through the pillars of creation,
Why wouldn't they go back, at least to get supplies, to get what they needed so they could make it through?
That's right, Kalin said. George Cipher went through the boundary at Kingsport and then returned. Addie said that the boundary had to have a passage, a vent, like where these people banished criminals. So why couldn't people come back in? There was a pass out, so why did they never return?
The men nodded, curious to hear why no one ever came back.
From the first, I've wondered the same thing. Richard rubbed a thumb along the glossy black surface of the statue of himself. I think that the boundaries in the Midlands had to have an opening through them because they were so big so long. This boundary here is nothing compared to those. I doubt that the same kind of vent would be needed. Because it was just one bend section of a boundary and not very long, I suspect that Khaja Rang was able to put in a pass that allowed criminals to be banished through it, but would not allow passage back in. After all, if a criminal was banished and found he couldn't escape, he would return. Khaja Rang wouldn't have wanted that to happen.
How could such a thing work? Jensen asked.
Richard rested his left hand on the hilt of his sword. Certain snakes can swallow prey much larger than themselves. Their teeth are angled back so that as the prey is devoured, it's impossible for it to come back out to escape. I suppose that the pass through the boundary could have been somehow like that, only able to be traversed in one direction.
Do you think such a thing is possible? Jensen asked.
There is precedent for such safeguards, Kalin said. Richard nodded his agreement. The Great Barrier between the New and Old World had defenses to allow certain people, under specific conditions, one passage through and back, but not two. He pointed the warning beacon up at the statue. A wizard of Khaja Rang's ability would surely have known how to craft a pass through the boundary that did not allow any return. After all, he called it up out of the underworld itself, and it remained viable for nearly 3,000 years.
So then anyone who went out of this boundary died? Owen said.
Richard nodded. I'm afraid so. Khaja Rang appeared to have made elaborate plans that functioned as he intended for all this time. He even made contingencies, should the boundary fail.
That's something I don't understand, a young man said. If this wizard was so great and his magic was so powerful that he could make a wall of death to keep us separated from the world for 3,000 years, then how could it possibly fail? In the last 2 years, it simply went away. Why?
I believe it was because of me, Kalin said. She took a step closer to the man. Richard didn't try to stop her. At this point, it wouldn't do to appear as if he were withholding information from them.
A couple of years ago, in a desperate act to save Richard's life, I inadvertently called forth underworld power that I believe may be slowly destroying magic in our world. Richard banished this evil magic, but it had been here in the world of life for a time, so the effects may be irreversible.
Worried looks passed among the men. This woman before them had just admitted that because of something she'd done, their protection had failed. Because of her, horrifying violence and brutality had befallen them. Because of her, their way of life had ended.
Chapter 43.
You still have not shown us your magic, one of the men finally said.
Richard's hand slipped away from the small of Kalin's back as he stepped toward the men.